This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
There is a queer angle to every issue, and we will find it. But don't expect us to be nice or politically correct. Nothing is sacred, and the team will be finding the queer and profane wherever we can on Joy 94.9. Is nothing sacred?
Hi there, Joysters. You are on this Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. It's 10 o'clock. And this is Jim. I'm here in the studio with Claire. Hello, Claire. And I'm in the studio with James.
Hello.
And Steph.
Hello.
And we've just heard from a new show called Her Story, which is a great new show for young lesbians. And that was a really good introduction. Good on you, girls.
First ever episode. Yay.
Well done.
So girl power.
Stay in tune. Stay tuned for that next Monday night before us as well.
And our new neighbours.
They've got lots of messages too, I can tell you.
Yeah, one of them says amazing program.
Woo. It is. So this has been a big week, hasn't it, Steph?
A big week in the world of news, in the world of the world.
In the world of the world, in the world of gay news and other things, things that we're interested in on this program. We've had... We've had a week when Senator Erica Betts, or as he's more known on social media, Senator Erica Betts.
Well, all bets are off.
Yeah, who is the leader of the government in
I
the Senate.
I find that a bit sexist, to be honest.
Nevertheless, that's what he's been called. I'm only commenting. And he claimed, along with the Agriculture Minister, Barnaby Joyce, that we needed to be very, Australia, needed to be very careful about promoting marriage equality because it would alienate our trading partners in Asia. And then the news broke that South Korea, which is our third biggest trading partner, I think, is making tentative moves to toward marriage equality. And there are local governments in Japan who have all announced that they're going to recognise localised same-sex marriage. And then Nepal announced it was going to consider
Nepal.
It was going to consider it.
Go Nepal.
Yeah, that's even after an earthquake. You know, so obviously the gays didn't cause that earthquake. Yeah. And then it was announced that Vietnam has removed its ban on same-sex marriage, which means that there's no impediment now to same-sex marriage in Vietnam.
Doesn't that just show that this is clutching at straws now?
Yeah, that's what I think.
It does. It shows that the arguments that they're trying to make are now just being pulled out of thin air because they're worried and they're desperate and they've got to be able to keep up. They're trying to keep up with the social conservatives in their party.
And don't you think as well it's a reflection of how far backwards we've become that it becomes we're looking to find more backwards-looking economies.
Yeah. So if we were going to not do things because of some of those countries, we'd reintroduce the death penalty. We would get rid of the minimum wage. We wouldn't have free education or social services or pensions or anything like that because most of those countries don't.
Mm. And it's so inconsistent for the government to be, you know, looking down their noses at some of our Asian neighbours and then suddenly they get desperate and go, oh, no, but we have to be more like them.
Sheer desperation.
But there have been other really interesting things that have happened this week too. The Prime Minister has done us a favour by banning front benches off our time slot competitor Q&A. So you might as well listen to us. We are much more informative now. And plus, the big news of the week, I think, is that the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition met with 40 Indigenous leaders, and so a big step has been taken toward some form of recognition in the Constitution for First Nations of Australia.
And while we're at it, we should say Happy NAIDOC Week.
And it is NAIDOC Week.
Happy NAIDOC Week.
And whether or not it's the recognition in the Constitution, which some people are arguing for, or whether it's a treaty, that's all going to be talked about in a white paper that's going to be a discussion paper that's going to be developed out of this meeting that they had. And there were quite a variety of views, I noticed, watching some of the commentary on TV by Indigenous leaders. But, you know, I had a long talk with an Indigenous friend last week who said to me, listen, recognition is just white fellas' business, really. It's got nothing to do with the Aborigines. We don't need to be recognised by you lot. You need to work out yourselves whether you want to recognise Aboriginal people as First Nations. So you go and fix that up and then come back and talk to us.
Did the person have a preference on a treaty?
Treaty.
or recognition?
Well, they like both.
Mm.
And they're not mutually exclusive. I mean, the best thing, in my opinion, to do, and I think lots of Aboriginal people's positions, would be negotiate in good faith a treaty with some form of organisation that is representative of Aboriginal people or First Nations people. Put recognition into the constitution in the form of a treaty,
and respectfully acknowledge it in our education systems as well.
Well, all of that, but that's not constitutional recognition. No, but it would later, be a good idea
later. Yeah.
Well, I'd like lots of things to be respectfully acknowledged in our education systems. Whether they will be or not is another issue.
Mm.
So that was a big week. Mm. So, Steph, what have we got on the show tonight?
Well, we've got a bit of a mixed bag on the show. There's a bit of a theme that runs through. But first off, I went along to the Young Social Pioneers pitch-ups a week ago. So there's a group of 52 young people from around Australia. The youngest is 15, and I have to say, a bit of a genius. He was on Triple J last night, being his usual genius self. So all of these young people are people who are starting up either social enterprises or not-for-profits or some kind of business with a social purpose. So they've been involved in a bit of an incubator program for the last 2 months. And then I went and chatted to three young women a week ago, just before they were doing their pitch up. So the pitch ups is when they have to do a 3-minute talk to a corporate or philanthropic organization in the hope of winning some cash to kickstart their business or to kind of work on the next project.
Oh, it's the devil's lair, is it?
Not the devil's lair. They're all very socially minded, wonderful young people, very inspiring.
I mean, you know, it was like that apprentice show that was on TV where they had to go
far kinder recipients.
When
and
you
then
have,
they said,
yeah,
you're out.
Yeah, a bit like Survivor.
Yeah.
Well, it's pretty inclusive, but yeah, not everyone gets money. So I won't tell you now who gets money and who doesn't.
Well, what
we
else?
can always comment more on politics.
We could comment on politics as much as we like on this show, and we can and we will. So what's grabbed you this week, James?
Oh, well, I suppose what we touched on, which was we're now taking advice from economies that we probably shouldn't, and countries that have the death penalty for gay marriage is now for the death penalty for being gay is now apparently a good thing to follow or emulate, which is just kind of ridiculous.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Yeah, so my project is Code Society. So we go in and give coding classes at a year 10 level, either in holidays or after school, and bring students up to a level of coding so that they can perform a coding task for our company that delivers software development for Australian industry.
And what led you to developing this project? Why is coding important for you?
I think everyone should know how to code in 21st century Australia. I graduated from university, a very well-educated individual. However, I had no exposure to tech. And as Australia's economy becomes more and more STEM-related, I watch my job opportunities shrink before my eyes, and I don't want that to happen to future Australians. Mm.
Do you have a particular interest in women in tech, or you think it's important for all young Australians?
I think it's important for all young Australians, but as a woman, I do think there needs to be more girls. I think everything should be more diverse. But, yeah, this program's aimed at everyone because I'm concerned about the broader Australian STEM education issue, but girls is a major issue as well.
Cool. All right, I'll just make sure that your call was okay. Right. Hello. Yeah, all right. Can you tell me a bit about your project?
My project is called Treat Yourself. I run that with the help of my community group, Youth in Action for Suicide Prevention. So we aim to prevent youth suicide by teaching people aged 15 to 24 adaptive coping strategies and problem-solving skills.
What kind of strategies do you teach people?
Well, everyone's strategy is actually unique to them because different people cope in different ways and not everyone can just, you know, pick up a one-size-fits-all solution. So the workshops we're currently developing will teach people how to identify their own unique coping strategies and what's going to work for them so that they can develop a personalised plan and implement that throughout their life.
Is there a particular story that you want to tell about why this area is so important for you?
It's not really one story that sums that up. Suicide prevention is what I do with my life. I've been a carer for people with suicidal thoughts. I volunteer at Lifeline. My paid employment is all about suicide as well. I study it. I live and breathe suicide prevention, so it's my mission to make sure that no one feels the need to end their life because they can cope with whatever life throws at them.
Is there one message that you want to tell people about suicide that you think everyone should know?
If you think someone's in trouble, ask them. You cannot put the idea in their head. That's the best thing you can do, to just approach them, say, I'm worried, how are you doing? Is there anything I can do to help?
So this afternoon you're doing your pitch to which organisation?
PwC for me.
And?
Shine On Foundation.
How are you feeling about that pitch?
Not too bad. Hoping that I don't twist my words like I am currently. But yeah, as long as I nail the pitch, I'll be happy, whatever the result.
Both excited and terrified by the opportunity. It's such a lot of money for a young community group to be able to get their hands on and hopefully do some good in the community. So I'm really excited about it.
And if you are successful, what are you going to do with the $10,000?
For us, it'll be finalising our content so that our first camps in December will be a success.
We're going to be holding our very first self-care interactive theatre performance to teach up to 800 young people some self-care skills to get our program up and running.
And can I ask you about being a young entrepreneur? What message would you give to Australia or to the government about supporting young, so particularly young social entrepreneurs in Australia?
Support it. I think that young social entrepreneurs can really make a difference, and I personally think the way Australia is going, we really need to shake it up. So support it, do what you can, and just go out there and do it.
I think the one thing I'd like everyone to know is don't doubt that people can achieve what they want just because of their age. My favourite quote is, a baby shark is still a shark.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You are on Joy 94.9. This is Nothing Sacred. And we do have a podcast. You can check it out on the Joy website. That's joy.org.au. We put it up every week. Thanks very much to our excellent podcaster, James Rothery.
And it is there from our last podcast was the one that we did with Adejoke Tugbayele from New York, the Nigerian lesbian artist.
What a fantastic interview that was as well.
Yeah. That was a really good interview you did with Madeline Joe.
So it was on site at the Docklands Library, actually. So you can hear it's a bit of a different sound.
Is there a library in the Docklands?
It is, I have to say, the most amazing library possible. I don't know if in the world, but one of the best libraries. It's all funky. It's all like timber and environmental and pretty.
Is it part of the City Library or is it part of the Victorian State Library?
I think it's part of the City Library. I think it's a Melbourne Council library, but it's really beautiful. If you live in Melbourne and haven't been there, I highly recommend going down. It's a bit of a stroll, but it's so beautiful and it looks out over the water. And if you think you don't like Docklands, it might make you like Docklands a little bit. It's a very, very beautiful space.
Amazing young women.
Yes. So for those of you who have just tuned in, we're talking to some of our young social pioneers who are young people aged 15 to 30 who are starting up their own social enterprise or not-for-profit organisation. I went along to their pitch-ups a week ago where they were pitching for funding in the hope of getting $10,000. So we were just speaking. I'd spoken to Madeline Mooney and Joe White. And now we have one more interview with a third pioneer. This is Madeline Buckner, who runs Little Dreamers.
Hi, my name's Maddie Buckner and I'm from Melbourne.
Can you tell us a bit about your project?
So my project is called the Dream Coaching Platform, run by an organisation called Little Dreamers that I established when I was 16. So Little Dreamers supports young carers in the community, so the people that are often forgotten in the family network when there's a sick child or parent. The Dream Coaching Platform is going to be working as an online support group run for young carers by young carers. featuring a space where they can talk and express themselves to people who understand them, and get a whole range of knowledge and tips and tricks at their fingertips when they need it most. And there'll also be a space for videos featuring famous young carers about how they overcame their struggles to achieve their dreams.
So how long have you been a carer for?
So I've been a carer since my brother turned 6 months old, so he's 3 years younger than me, so I guess since I was three. He was diagnosed with encephalitis, which is a swelling of the brain, when he was three, so I was six. And ever since then, he's been left with learning difficulties, epilepsy. He had chicken pox that went to his lungs. He's had whooping cough, everything under the sun. And my mum was diagnosed with breast cancer when I was 15. So I've since been caring for my mum, who's been left with quite bad rheumatoid arthritis in her hands as well.
What's it like taking on so much responsibility compared to other kids of your age, especially when you were so young?
It's difficult because not everyone understands why you do it or why family is so important to me, but I don't really know any different. So.
And were there any supports for young carers before you set up this project?
No. So when I was growing up, there was nothing for me. There was a lot of stuff for my brother. He was granted a Starlight Wish, which I got to go along with. We went on a holiday, but nothing specifically for me, no.
So we've got you've got the pitch up this afternoon. Which organisation are you pitching to?
So I'm pitching to the Bennelong Foundation.
And how are you feeling about the pitch up?
I'm feeling a bit nervous. I don't want to go in with any notes, so that's my aim. We'll see how we go.
And if you're successful, what are you going to spend the money on?
The $10,000 will help us to take our dream coaching platform live. We've got all the design stuff done. It will help us to market it and to increase the. It will help us to increase the support from just 5% of young carers, which are currently being supported, to 20%. So, at the moment, 2,500 young carers are supported a year through the resources that are available. We'll be able to support 150.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Yes, listeners, you are listening to Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. It's 27 minutes past 10, and they were great interviews, Steph, that you did with those entrepreneurs.
Thanks, Jim. Pretty amazing young women, I have to say.
I know, and we were just chatting in the studio about which ones we thought should win.
It's hard to choose.
And who wants to choose between coding for all kids, which is a good thing but is being dealt with in other ways at the moment, or suicide prevention or young carers?
Well, yes. I mean,
personally, I think coding will win because it's tangible and no one cares about the other things. Because if we cared about them, we would have done something about suicide prevention and young carers already.
I thought the young carers was just fantastic, but we're yet to hear from the suicide prevention.
No, so there were 52 young people who were pitching in the last fortnight. So they were three amazing young people, and there was another, I can totally do maths, 49 amazing young people who are starting up their own.
It's because you have a science degree. That's why you can do maths.
That's why I can do maths. So, yeah, I mean, these three people weren't competing against each other. They were competing within their own streams against people tackling challenges in a similar area. So I can say that Madeline Mooney, who had the Treat Yourself project for suicide prevention in Canberra, won $5,000 for her project. But I did speak to Maddie, who was the carer, and she assured me that she was not in the least bit deterred and she was going to find the money another way and continue to support young carers across Australia. I should say, because she didn't say in the interview, she started up that young carers organisation when she was 9 years old.
Oof.
9 years old, she started supporting other young carers, and she's now 22, I think.
She's a veteran.
Pretty
so
amazing.
Awesome. So awesome.
So awesome. Very inspiring.
They're the sorts of people that government should be seeking out, not waiting to apply for.
Exactly. Yeah. So we have Another interview now, which is from a couple of months ago. I also went along to the Future of Work conference, which is all about workplaces and what
this
it's going to be.
Instead of your work, was it?
Instead of going to actual work. Well, I did learn quite a lot, which has been quite useful for all of my many jobs. But I thought this one kind of linked in. So we just had three amazing young women who were all in their 20s, which is just incredible, running those organisations. And I did an interview at the Future of Work conference with Amy Mullins, who's the Executive Director of the Women's Leadership Institute Australia. So I had a bit of a chat to her about women leaders in the workplace.
So first off, I wanted to ask about women leaders. And looking to the future, do you feel optimistic about us getting closer towards gender parity in the workplace?
I'm cautiously optimistic. Nearly everyone has good intentions about making change and ensuring that there's gender diversity and gender equality, not only in the workplace, but in all facets of life. Where we kind of lose our focus can be unconscious bias, one of them, which we've noticed, but also just our culture. I think the Australian culture can be sometimes detrimental to the cause. So the Australian culture does err towards masculinity, which obviously comes from our history, as well as, you know, globally, where power has traditionally sat is with men. So that is a challenge, and it is particularly more of a challenge, I think, in Australia than some of the other countries in Europe, particularly in some of the other Asian countries like China, where women in business are really not seen in as much as in a gendered light. I think I know, for example, in South Korea, that's not the case. But what I do know is that the culture can tend to exclude people because it's not consciously including them. And I think a culture of inclusivity is really the most important thing. And that's something that you have to really think about and be intentional about and self-aware about. And so organisations making sure that they're more aware of it, but also acting upon that awareness and ensuring that that inclusion actually occurs is what will make change happen. So when you have leaders who really see the value in it and who understand that by excluding people, you're shooting yourself in the foot, you're not being competitive, you're disadvantaging yourself as well as other people professionally, I think that's when we'll actually make more headway. But I do think there is momentum now. In the last year, I think I've seen a real pickup in people talking about the issue and at least being more aware of it, and I think that's a really big step. And I also think that organisations and CEOs like the Male Champions of Change, like the Property Male Champions of Change, which I'm working with, I'm really confident that those people have seen the need for change and who really actually want to take action on it. So that's what really gives me heart, is to see good people wanting to do something and they have the power to do something about it.
With, I suppose, Generation Y people moving into management roles and Generation Z coming into the workforce, do you think that will change the culture in terms of more equality, or what impact do you think that might have?
I think there would be a slight impact, and I do see that people of my generation, of Generation Y, are more open-minded and don't necessarily see people as fitting into categories as much as we used to. However, we still do that because of biases. I do think that it will make a difference in terms of whether the real power lies at the moment is with those people in their 50, 60, 70 years, in terms of in companies, in politics, and even the younger politicians. You can kind of see that we are moving closer towards, for example, gay marriage, to focusing on real impact for women in terms of domestic violence, and, you know, preventing that, as well as supporting women and I guess educating men and helping them on their journey as well. But yeah, I think it's not going to be the one factor or the main factor. I think it's really always going to be an issue because, inherently there is this culture, I guess, it's really solidified, and throughout every structure in every society, it's predominantly male in some way, and it supports a male view of the world, and the male view is universal. So I think that we need to challenge the woman as other, which is what Simone de Beauvoir said quite a while ago. It's still, unfortunately, really relevant now. And I think actually going back and looking at things theoretically and philosophically can be quite helpful. And just talking about it isn't enough, but really understanding it and embedding it as a system and a value within us.
I guess one another thing we see is women facing more barriers in tech. So things like you look at the rates of women enrolling in IT courses at uni, you know, read things such as articles you've written yourself about the response to women online, and I guess vitriolic responses we see on social media with things like Gamergate and that kind of thing. As we move into the future and technology becomes more important, is that going to be a new challenge for women to face? And I guess, what can we do about it? What's the angle we should come in at to increase women's access to technology?
I think that starting really, really early is important. As soon as your child is born, whether it be a boy or a girl, give them access to both things, male or traditionally male things and female things, or neutral things. Make things more gender neutral than they currently are. I think what really is an issue is that IT and engineering has an advertising problem. I think it has been traditionally male. That doesn't mean that it's not a thing that women would excel in. It's advertised as a male thing. Most of our class is male. You probably don't fit in here. It sends out all of these subtle, really, really damaging stereotypes and intimidating imagery that can put women off even thinking that that's an option. So it can often mean that, you know, a girl maybe in high school, she's really excited about computing, and then she sees all around that, you know, that's just not a thing girls do, through the signs and the symbols and the messages underneath that are saying, you know, most guys do this, this isn't for you. And that won't prevent everyone, but it will prevent the people who even had a thought bubble that it might be something they want to pursue. So, and in the same thing as men pursuing traditionally female things, I think we really need to see that sometimes or often gender stereotypes hinder rather than assist, and making sure that men feel that they don't have to fit a particular category or stereotype of masculinity and power and aggression is important. At the same time, making sure that women feel that they don't need to be nurturing or motherly or passive is really important too, because, you know, your personality is what should shine through. It doesn't matter about gender. So, and I think that's something that I've particularly struggled with myself, is that I probably have a personality that's not traditionally female, and certainly I'm quite assertive, I'm tactful in my assertiveness, but seen within a traditional context of gender, it can often be, oh, she's a bit forthright, oh, I didn't expect that from a woman, you know. So I think, and the same point with men who aren't alpha males and are CEOs. If they're, you know, a bit quiet, they're maybe nerdier or they're more softly spoken, then people will often say, oh, well, he doesn't really fit into the club, he doesn't really get it, you know, he's an outsider. I think we need to make sure that we're not making these judgments, or if we do, and, you know, we don't consciously do, then we need to make sure that we correct ourselves.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Hi there, Joysters. Your own is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. And that was an interview with Amy Mullins from the Women's Leadership Institute of Australia. And then it followed up with a fabulous song, of course.
We've got a new member that's just joined.
We have a message here, a new member, James from South Bank, who has joined. Thank you, James. We like you for joining. And you've given us a business donation too of $35 on top of that. So that's wonderful.
Keeping us on air.
Thank you.
Steph will be keeping very us happy. On air.
I am very, very happy. We, yes, are very, very grateful for
Steph,
all.
Steph, the secretary of the board, is very happy about that.
Steph, the secretary of the board, is always very grateful for all all financial donations. Thank you so much for everyone and everyone who contributed during Radiothon as well.
Yeah, that was a great effort. And in fact, the results of Radiothon and the winner of the car will be announced fairly soon, I believe. Is that right?
Fairly soon.
Good. Must be in the next week or so.
We can't win, which is sad.
I know. It's a shocker, isn't it?
It is a shocker. So we now have one more interview for tonight. It's also a pre-record. This one is in a studio, so you won't hear like you did the last one, everyone walking around at the conference behind my interviewee.
And the wind blowing.
And the wind blowing.
At least we get a feeling for where you were.
You can tell that I'm in the Docklands, more of like...
Yes.
Yeah.
It's rare to get no wind in the Docklands.
I have to say, the only time I've ever been down there, I was trying to have a conversation on my phone, and I had to go and find one of those... inlet doorways, you know, where people run out of buildings if they burn down, which they are doing in the Docklands, apparently. So I could stand in there with, there was no noise of the wind because no one could hear me on the other end of the phone.
Common problem in Docklands, common problem, I'm sure.
But being improved.
It's
and
a first world problem.
This is a question that I did ask the person in this next interview. So we have Austin Lay, who is one of the research managers at the City of Melbourne Council. And so the theme going through tonight is a bit of a work focus, a bit of a future-facing focus. So I spoke to Austin about the City of Melbourne. I should say this is Melbourne Council, so it's not just right in the city centre, but also including Docklands and the surrounding areas, about what's happening in Melbourne in the future.
So what is the City of Melbourne doing now to prepare for the future of work in Melbourne?
Well, broadly, we're continuing to make Melbourne a great place to both work and live, thanks largely to technology. Everyone's available sort of 24/7, and there's an interesting exercise where they ask people how many people check their emails when they're sort of on the weekend or at night, and everyone's explained, yes, they do. You know, we're all mixing work and pleasure, I suppose, and general living. A livable city is a workable city. That's, I suppose, the broad theme. And Melbourne is very much a livable city, and so we need to continue to make sure that it stays that way, and it will therefore be attractive to the sort of future workers. And then if we move more specifically, the future of work is going to be based on growing what we call our knowledge sector. And our knowledge sector is based around the excellent professional and technical skills and expertise that we've got, and there are wonderful research institutions and assets that we have. We need to capitalise on those and grow new businesses and create new jobs, and that's where we see our future of work.
So you've been working for the City of Melbourne for quite a long time, is that right? 20 years, is that right?
I have, yes.
So I guess you must have seen a lot of change in that time. What's some of the things that have changed over the last 20 years in the City of Melbourne?
Well, I could sum it up in one word, and that's dynamism. I think Melbourne's a far more dynamic city than it was back in the 1990s when I started. And just in terms of numbers, I suppose, 20 years ago, the City of Melbourne's population was around 40,000, and about 140,000 people worked here. And it was largely a sort of 9-to-5 weekday city. Now its population is over 120,000. It's one of the fastest growing municipalities in Australia. It has been for a number of years. And around 440,000 people work in the city every day, and around 840,000 people use the city on a typical weekday. So the city's look and feel has changed quite dramatically over that time, and the sense of the city being far more than just a 9-to-5 working place, but it's got so much more to offer, and that's, I think, one of the biggest changes that's occurred.
What about looking forward? What changes do you expect to see, or what have you got planned for the next 20 years?
Well, there's more growth, more people living and working and visiting the city. So we'll be looking at probably a couple of 100,000 people or so living in the city, and then, you know, about 1 million people or more actually coming to the city every day. So that's, again, a very dynamic city. And we need to be able to maintain and improve, if you like, the quality of life that we have. And as I mentioned before, the quality of life or livability of the city is similar to the workability of it, the way that people can do a variety of things within the City of Melbourne. We're very much trying to look at how to accommodate that growth in the coming decades and to ensure that we maintain that particular quality of life and to sort of see that growth occur in a sustainable way.
I guess one area that's increased quite a lot in terms of population is the Docklands area, and there's been some discussion about it being really lovely in some ways, but perhaps not having the same kind of character as other parts of the city of Melbourne. Is that going to be a focus as well, trying to have a more of a community emphasis?
I think definitely the Docklands needs to have a more of a community feel to it. I think it's got, it has the built form, and it was developed quite quickly and has, in a sense, that buildings and the environment. But I think it does need the community element there, and that will grow, that will come over time. But certainly Council's been working with the people in the Docklands to look at how to actually bring that to the Docklands area. And I think that's a certainly something that's quite exciting about the future and the changes in the future, is how that will become a feature of Melbourne, more perhaps than it has been in the past, in terms of the community aspects of Docklands.
And I guess living in Melbourne, something that we pride ourselves on is often being labelled one of the world's most livable cities. Over the last 20 years, have you figured out what the secret is to creating a livable city?
I think we have done it well in Melbourne, because it's about listening to the community and what the community wants. And the plans that we've had over this time have been based on consultation with the community. And the last iteration of that was developed, it's called Future Melbourne, was developed by the community and expressed the community's aspiration for the city. And each council has looked at what it can do to implement or advocate for those aspirations. So what we have is a focus on a city for people and a creative city, one that has prosperity, that's prosperous, and as I mentioned before, the future of that prosperity is going to be based on building our knowledge and capitalising on the knowledge, expertise and assets we have. But we need to be sustainable, so the eco-city theme is there, and connected. They're the key elements that have come out of that consultation that really are the ingredients for a livable city. And I think Melbourne's an example or an exemplar for other cities as to how to achieve that. Perhaps one of the most recent developments on that is that we now recognise that the city needs to be resilient. And in that sense, what that means is that we need to prepare people for anything that might happen of a substantial change, either man-made or natural impact, and to know how to, what to do during a particular event, what to, how to recover from it as well. So building in that sustainability and resilience to what we have, I think, is particularly important.
Yeah, I think that's going to be pretty relevant for a lot of places across the country in the coming decades.
Yes, yes, exactly. And where we've identified that, and we are looking at how we approach it, we have a Chief Resilience Officer who is funded by the Rockefeller Foundation for a couple of years. And in fact, Council has just approved the development of a partnership with University of Melbourne for a professorial chair in city resilience to be funded over 5 years. So the resilience officer will develop a framework for Melbourne, and that's broader Melbourne. And now we have also an ability to look at how we can actually ensure that that framework that will be developed will be actually researched and worked on over the next 5 years as well. So it's a very, I think, encouraging thing that that Council's done there.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
And good lot of interviews there, Steph. You'll have
to get out your
travelling mic again over the next couple of weeks. Now, look, Joyce, as we've done a lot of planning and we've got lots of big shows programmed for the coming weeks for the rest of this grid, so get ready for that. There should be some super guests and super issues, some of which we've covered before, but we're going to revisit.
Right, absolutely. And thank you again to our guests who I interviewed in the last couple of months, to Madeline Mooney, Joe White, Madeline Buckner, Amy Mullins and Austin Lay. It is 3 minutes to 11. We're saying goodnight.
Good night, guys.
Good night,
everyone.
See you next week, metaphorically.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.